REOs, Conrad. Can you believe it?
REOs, we've made it.
All right. So let's get started on the Real Estate Think Tank, the podcast.
Let's go.
Episode 5, and welcome to TRET, the Real Estate Think Tank podcast. So today, as we said in the opening, we're going to be talking about REOs, short sales, and foreclosures. So I'm excited to get into that topic, but I'm more excited to hear about how my man is doing. What's up, Conrad? How you been?
Man, I'm good. Chilling. Just, you know, working hard. Still doing my trucking and working hard with this whole real estate thing because, this is where I want to be. I've definitely been putting in the time and, you know, I love the grind. So my goal is to make this a full-time endeavor.
That's awesome, man. For me, things have been going pretty well. Got some good momentum. Happy to get back into the swing of things. The weather is turning around, so it's awesome. But I do want to point out a book that I've been reading. It's called It Will Never Work by Mark Randolph. It talks about the start of Netflix. And it's a really awesome book if you're into business books, if you're into entrepreneur books. Really awesome book. Goes through the idea all the way until the IPO. He does it in an approachable way. And he does it in a way that makes you feel like if you really tried hard enough, you could do it. But it's also understandable. There is some technical jargon, but not a whole lot.
You know, it sounds pretty deep. And, you know, I've got a list of books that's piling up on me. I mean, I keep coming across so much great material. I'm definitely need to add that one to the list.
Cool. So let's get right into the topic. We're talking about REOs, short sales, and foreclosures. Let's just start with a definition. An REO is short for, or an abbreviation for, real estate owned. And what that is a property that is owned by a lender, a bank, a lending institution, after having undergone a foreclosure process. And these are hot topics when you talk about real estate investment, because oftentimes they're thought of as opportunities. Oftentimes the banks are seen as distressed sellers. Oftentimes the properties are themselves distressed. And so we want to go into this topic and shed a little light on the subject. Conrad, as a realtor, and I as an attorney that's actually worked for the banks, has taken properties through foreclosure, has managed foreclosures, and at some point in the distant past was a realtor on these things.
You know, the funny part, this actually is an opportunity for me to share a real life personal story regarding foreclosure in the process, at least part of it, especially from not just the side of the bank, but also the side of a person that had to go through it. With my mother getting sick, I ended up having to make a decision. And I guess we can, you know, flesh it out here. And just like, you know, a lot of us, I'd like to learn, is this the best decision? When is it the best decision? I can definitely get some insight into some of the steps that's required and some of the feelings and emotions and definitely maybe even some antidotes for not just how to avoid getting in this situation, but also if you have to, you know, it's not the end of the world. We live in a very forgiving country, America, and there's plenty of people, I mean, very, very big people that we know that have had to go through bankruptcy, foreclosure, all that kind of stuff. But our country allows for forgiveness and we can definitely rebuild and come back. And I think this is a great topic and a lot of people should be able to identify with this.
Yeah, thank you for that, because that's a great way to personalize this topic. In the world of real estate, we can kind of get caught up in properties and numbers And we can't lose sight of the fact that there are real stories here mm-hmm. on both the residential and on the commercial side. Mm-hmm. An REO we already spoke about, but that's different from a foreclosure. Foreclosure is actually the process through which the REO happens. So it's the process by which a lender regains or retakes a property on which it either had a lien or it had a deed of trust. And then when we get to short sales are different from both of those other terms because a short sale is a transaction in which a defaulted property or a property that's subject to a defaulted mortgage is then sold for an amount less than the amount of the mortgage or the amount agreed upon for the deed of trust, and instead is sold to a third-party buyer, and the bank or the lending institution agrees to take a smaller amount of money than originally agreed upon when the loan was given.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, I can tie that in as well because, you know, in the situation I was in, you know, I wasn't sure if that made the most sense and the timing and, you know, with all the crazy whirlwind things that was going on in life, you know, like you said, this is a great way to personalize this. And I'm sure there's going to be people who can identify with, you know, having to make some tough choices and some tough situations. And then there's always, you know, besides the borrower, you know, the lender should be considered too, because I think there's a great example of how some people might feel like because you're on one side of the table that you're not affected. You know, like, for example, a tenant might not respect the fact that a landlord has a mortgage to pay. They might just look at the perspective of, oh, well, you own this property, so you must be in a better financial position than me. So it really doesn't matter if I don't pay you this money that we agreed upon. So, you know, I think this is definitely a great way for lots and lots of people to be able to identify and even to even learn or become enlightened as far as the other side of the table.
We become so connected to our side or our perspective, we forget that there are some real motivations on the other side. And a lot of times the other side isn't the villain. It's just that they have motivations. So if you think back to the crash of 2008, 2009, a lot of the times the story was told from the borrower's perspective as these greedy banks were giving out all this money and they tricked people into signing these mortgages with very low documents and incentivized people with this cheap money to live the American dream on a very, very high level. And how could you turn down this money if the American dream is about property? And then on the other side, the banks were saying these irresponsible borrowers lied to us through these loans, and we just wanted to give them more freedom to make their dream of owning a house an opportunity that they could come by, because before the guidelines were so stringent that a lot of people were cut out of the market and they used this opportunity against us. And both sides were painting each other as the villain, when really and truly it was an opportunity for a lot of people to do a lot of things they couldn't have done in the past due to lax regulations and due to a lot of frothiness in the market, people just being interested in being exposed to real estate. And both sides did some things that maybe they shouldn't have. And so when we start to look at motivations, it starts being less about somebody being evil or trying to take advantage of you. And it starts to be more about, well, this is what the person on the other side of the transaction is looking to do. And therefore, I need to respect that they have certain parameters and certain limitations. And I can only act in accordance with that.
You know what? I agree, but that's definitely a big can of worms that can be opened, you know, depending on which angle you want to come from. Because, you know, I look at the fact that when you provide products to people that allow them to live above their means, that is a double-edged sword. You can look at the fact that, hey, you know, you now have the ability to pay me over time, but you create this lifestyle that you normally would not be able to indulge in. But at the same time, I feel like, you know, that rabbit hole goes deep, because as a society, it's not always the best thing to essentially rob your future self. And that's what you do sometimes when you use debt, whether it's on, you know, a piece of property, you know, an automobile, a boat, credit card. So there's definitely a couple ends of the spectrum that we could look at. And, I think it's important for us to just discuss both sides, because it's not as if that we're anti-bank or anti-living good, but I do think it's important just to make sure we establish the fact that you should be paying attention, because the side that has the asset and the money and can lend it to you, that they're going to have different motivations, just like the person who wants to borrow the money or acquire the asset, they are going to have their motivation. So I think that's really, really important.
That's why I love doing this podcast, because we really could have a discussion about personal responsibility on the end, yep, on the side of the borrower versus incentivization and
morality.
Right. And moral hazard when it comes to your customer as a lender, you know, right? If you incentivize your customers to do certain things, are you then responsible for what they do? Furthermore, if by incentivizing those customers to do certain things, you then put yourself and them in a worse position, is that something that you should be held accountable for? Mm-hmm. Or is it this idea that you were enabled by irrational irresponsibility? There's no answer to that. Yeah. I know that there are people on different sides that believe that they, yep, have the answer. Yep. And I guess that's what makes our market so great, is that if there was an answer, then we could all click C, right?
Yeah.
And look at an outcome. All right. But all that said, it's important to even take a step further back and look at the lending process. Mm-hmm. What happens when you borrow money for a property is you are making a commitment to pay your lender back over whatever the terms are of the loan and given the conditions of the loan. So you sign various documents that allow you to borrow money. And those documents say, well, you have to pay us back this amount. This is how long you have to pay us back. This is how frequently you're going to have to pay us back. And here are the rules. Now, that's the most simplified way that I can describe a loan. And notice how I'm not saying mortgage, because a loan can actually take two forms once you have executed it. So you have the loan and that gives you the money, but now you have to think about, well, what have I promised in exchange for this money? And you've basically promised that if you get this money, you will pay it back or the lender can take the property. And in some places, that takes the form of a mortgage. And so a mortgage is something that a property owner gives to a lender in order for them to get the right to receive money.
Can you say that one more time? Because you just said there is definitely the proper definition that I'm going to have to say. I'm sure you're going to agree. Most people think the bank is giving you a mortgage.
Right.
So can you say that again, please?
Sure. The mortgage is the right that the property owner gives to the bank to later claim against the property in exchange for the money that's given in the loan. So the property owner is giving the mortgage to the bank. Now, every state actually doesn't proceed through a mortgage. In some states, rather than a mortgage, in order to secure a loan, you do what is called a deed of trust. So a deed of trust is when you just take the title and you give it to a trustee. A trustee is a third party, somebody who's not involved in the transaction. They hold the title in the name of the bank. So legal title goes to the bank, but equitable title goes to the owner of the property, meaning the owner of the property has all of the rights of a property owner, but legally the title is in care of the bank and it's being held by a trustee. So what that means is that title is split. Part of the rights go to the property owner and the title goes to the trustee in care of the bank or the lending institution. If you're in a state that uses mortgages, then what you have is you have a lien on the title. The owner owns the property, but there is a claim for the amount of money that was lent that's on the title, And if it's not paid off, that claim can then turn into a right to take the property. And that's a big difference, because when it comes to how long a foreclosure process will take, when it comes to how you actually go through the foreclosure process, if you're in a deed of trust state, the process is very different than if you are in a mortgage state, or what we call a lien state. And we call it a lien state because the mortgage becomes a lien. Here is a list of states that are mortgage states and mortgage states only: Alabama, Arkansas, Connecticut, Delaware, Florida, Hawaii, Indiana, Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, North Dakota, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Carolina, South Dakota, Vermont, and Wisconsin.
That's interesting, because guess what? There's a very short list for deed of trust states. If you don't mind, I'll go ahead and knock off these deed of trust states, because I live in one. The following states that use deeds of trust are Alaska, Arizona, California, District of Columbia, Georgia, Mississippi, Missouri, or Misery, like we like to call it, and Nevada, North Carolina, and Virginia. So I noticed South Carolina is a lien state, North Carolina is a deed of trust. So do you know much about the history for why states are what they are?
It's a local decision. So states, all real estate laws are local. And so states decide within their legislatures how to move forward. Now, you might have noticed that we left some states out, and these are states that you can do both. And these are Colorado, Idaho, Illinois, Iowa, Maryland, Montana, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Oregon, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Wyoming, Washington State, and West Virginia. It's important to know which state the security interest in the loan will take, because that will tell you how you're going to proceed, or and if you ever get into default. And hopefully no one deals with default. In the instance that you are an investor that is looking for distressed properties, then the strategy will depend upon where you are and how that state deals with securing a loan. So let's go through the default process.
Just to put a bow on what we were saying, because I feel like I'm back in real estate school and learning all these things. So a deed conveys ownership. A deed of trust secures a loan. You know, that's another thing that I definitely want to stress, because I feel like where we can, we should educate, because I'm sure there's people who aren't as seasoned that are going to listen to the show. And, you know, I'm sure your goal, Stefan, too, is as well, is for people to be able to accomplish things in life and say, hey, you know what? On Tret, I learned this. And look, I can now take this knowledge and apply it practically out here in the real world. So, boom.
Yes, that's right. And if I wasn't clear before, a deed of trust is held for the lender. It is held by a third party. It's usually a title company or escrow company. But yes, you're right. A deed itself is conveyed to the property. A deed of trust is a security interest. It's a way to hold the property until a loan is paid off. God forbid anybody goes through this, but what happens with the default process? There are some similarities between both the mortgage and the deed of trust process. Once you get 90 days behind, which is typically three payments behind, and I say typically because there are some mortgages that don't have monthly payments, but most of them do. When you get about 90 days behind, there is a notice of default, or a 90-day notice that goes out, and that is across the board. In every single state, you will get a 90-day notice that lets you know that you are in default. It lets you know how much the amount is that you have missed, and it lets you know how you can cure it. All right. And it's important that the notice of default state all of those things, because the purpose of the notice of default is twofold. It's to make you aware of the fact that you're defaulted and the amount that you have defaulted. It's also to make you aware that the default is serious enough that the lender may proceed on their rights to collect. We'll just proceed with as if this was a mortgage, and then we'll come back and we'll do the deed of trust. In a lien state, after the 90-day mortgage, as soon as 120 days, but typically a little bit longer than that, there is a declaration of default and acceleration. So you've given the borrower 90 days to cure the default, to pay off the money, to make some arrangements that are acceptable. If that doesn't happen after some time, then with a mortgage, you then have to declare the loan in full default and then demand all of the money at once. Okay, so once that happens, you are in a different world, because from that point forward, the lender now has the ability to begin a foreclosure proceeding. And so they go down to the court and they file that foreclosure action. And then there are a number of steps that have to be taken with every single court case that's filed, because a foreclosure action is a court case. I really don't want to get into the technical procedures.
Yeah, the super minutiae here.
Yeah, of how to answer and stuff like that. I've done it hundreds of times, and I don't think that that's where we want to go with this.
Yeah.
So once that time has gone by, you know, you have a court case, just really quickly, there's a time to answer. The time to answer passes, then there are some motions that go through, because if you don't answer, then the lender will then say, well, they didn't answer in the case, push this case along, court. And so you basically go through a series of actions and motions that are made to push the case along until you get to a final judgment. If you do answer, you have a fight, you have a court case, and you go back and forth. And then after that, there's going to be some motions that go through to try to push the case forward. And at every step of the way, you can oppose those. Once we get to a certain point, there is this motion for a final judgment. And that's asking the court to do a number of things. And depending on your locale, this may come in parts or it may come all at once. The court has to appoint somebody to determine how much the property should be worth, to determine how to sell it, when to sell it, where to sell it, and to conduct that sale. Where I am is called the referee. And then the court is also going to determine that this court case is finished and that the property should be sold. So the court doesn't give the property to the lender. That is not the purpose of a mortgage. The purpose of a mortgage is to have the money come back to the lender. So what the court is trying to do is it's trying to force the sale of that property so that the money can come back to the lender. So I'm going to say that again. The purpose of the foreclosure is not to get the property. The court doesn't want to give the property over to the lender. That is not the idea. The lender actually probably doesn't even want the property. The whole purpose of this is so that there can be a sale so that the money can come back to the lender. That is the whole purpose. Now, if you get to the point where a judgment has been made, in some states you can pay off up to the point of the sale. In some states, the judgment cuts it off. It depends on the local laws. But then we're in a different world. And we are going to get to that explanation, but I want to go back and do the trust deed process as well, which is a shorter process. And then we'll proceed with the sale.
Yeah. And you know, me living in a deed of trust state and the experience that I had in South Carolina, you know, it's really interesting, because what happened in my situation was my mother was living in her home. I was living in mine. But when she went and had her surgery and then she wasn't there and the payments started being missed on her property, I was faced with a decision, and I might have brought this up to you, Stefan, and I don't mind being transparent, because I think, you know, this is important. This isn't a super unique situation. Maybe my mother's illness and how things lined up was, but I mean, as far as ending up where you have to decide short sale, foreclosure, you know, and stuff like that, this happened many, many times to many, many people. And, you know, like we alluded to in earlier episodes, who knows what the future holds? But in regards to this situation, a lot of stuff Stefan already talked about, that's what I remember. The bank started saying, hey, you know, these payments are missed, and it came to my attention. And then I started to feel the pressure of, okay, I just wasn't in a position to pay, you know, my living expenses as well as hers while she was recuperating. So I got to the point where I had to start learning and understanding, okay, a foreclosure means this. You know, short sale means that. The situation that I was in, I felt like a short sale, which was getting the bank to agree to let us sell the property for, shorter or less than what we owed was an option. But I was looking at it from the perspective of, okay, is it possible for us to sell this property and to be able to get anything out of it? So what I had learned in my mother's personal situation was that she had taken out a second mortgage. Basically, when you have a property and you have some equity, meaning what you owe is less than what the property is worth, a bank sometimes will lend you based on how much of that is available. So my mother did some repairs and upgrades on the property. So she essentially had two mortgages. So at this time, when it came time to consider foreclosure, short sale, or just a traditional sale, I learned that the value of the property was at one place, but what the opinion of some realtors was saying was that we're basically going to end up owing. So we weren't in a situation where we could sell the property and actually receive money. And honestly, with the whirlwind of dealing with my mother's sickness and trying to figure out how to get caught up, I started getting overwhelmed and feeling like, well, did it really even matter? Which I'm sure we could talk about that too. Did it matter whether we did a short sale or foreclosure? The overwhelming feeling made me decide that it didn't really matter whether I actually took the time to find somebody to buy the property short, or I just essentially gave the property back to them. But I definitely say, you know, I have much more knowledge now on these processes and procedures. And a foreclosure is no good for anybody. It hurts the credit of the borrower. The bank now has to work hard to recoup the money that they were anticipating, and, you know, to make sure their investors are getting, you know, the return. So it's really a difficult situation.
That was actually an amazing story. And thank you for sharing that, Conrad, because there are a lot of people that got to be in a similar situation, maybe not factually the exact same situation, but they're facing foreclosure and they're trying to figure out what they should do and what their options are. Thankfully, we're in a time now where that's not a decision that needs to be mulled over, at least for the next couple of months, right? The moratorium, I believe, is until June 30th to start the actions. In most instances, that doesn't carry over to non-monetary foreclosures. So, for example, if somebody is trying to kind of get you out of your property because you're creating a nuisance or you're creating waste or is a hazardous situation, the moratorium does not extend to that. But we are definitely getting far off the course. I want to get back for a second into something that Conrad was talking about, which is the default process in a deed of trust state, because he actually operates in a deed of trust market. The property that he was talking about, his mother's property, was in South Carolina, which is a lien or a mortgage state. But he operates and is very familiar with the deed of trust way of securing the property. And so in a deed of trust, it's a much quicker process. Basically, you have the 90-day notice, and then after that, you have a notice of trustee sale. So 90 days, and then 30 days after that, 120 days out, if you're still defaulting, there is a notice of sale. You don't have to file a court case. You have to put everybody on notice, and a non-judicial foreclosure takes place. Shortly after that, the trustee conducts a sale under the state guidelines, and you're right at auction. So it's a much faster process. I actually Googled how long does it take to do a mortgage foreclosure, and it spit back 6 months. I can tell you that that is a very optimistic outlook. Up here in New York, talking at minimum, if everything goes well and just for some fluke, you get everything streamlined, 9 months. In many cases, it can be up to 18 months. And that's just to get to the sale. With the moratorium on a lot of these actions, we could be talking a long time. When I was representing the banks as an attorney, we were doing the tail end of what you call the legacy assets. So we're doing the tail end of the stuff that was going on during the market fall in 2008, 2009. And we saw people who hadn't paid on their mortgage in 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. And they were still going through the process. People who had cases that were started 3 years earlier. Up here in New York, there have been a lot of failure to prosecute claims. So basically the court starts looking at its cases and saying, well, wait a second, this has been on our docket for 2 years. You either do something with this or we dismiss this case and you got to refile it. And if you refile it, it's a lot of issues going on there, like statute of limitations, a lot of stuff you don't want to happen. So there was a push for that. I want to say in like around 2015, 2016, maybe even back in 2014, because the idea was there's so many foreclosures from 2008 and we need to get them through the pipeline, and letting people just do whatever is not going to do it. We're going to start dismissing people's cases. I'm not sure if there's that same pressure in other states, but that said, think about a case that you started 5 years ago and you're trying to get a foreclosure and you're trying to get the money back on that loan. And 5 years later, you still don't have that money. Think about if you're a borrower and 5 years later, you're still there. So it's a very weird state of circumstances, but it can get that bad. And I'm only mentioning that because it might be that bad again with foreclosures if there's not a creative solution, given that we have this moratorium. But that's all in contrast to the deed of trust, which could take 4 months, 5 months, because it's a non-judicial process. The trustee already holds the title. It's in the it's for the benefit of the lender. The property owner only just has equitable rights, the rights to use the property and act like an owner. So selling the property is a little bit quicker because you don't have to take the property, then get it in the name of the lender and then sell it, or get in the name. It's actually not even the name of the lender with the foreclosure process. It's in the name of the court or the referee who steps in for the homeowner that defaulted and then sells this thing. So you don't have to get somebody in a fictional place to sell this on behalf of a defaulted homeowner. That's already all taken care of. You just basically go through the process of selling.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I think this is a great definition for what we're talking about here. The beneficiary of a deed of trust, which would be
the lender,
right, may ask the trustee, which is a third party, which from what I understand is usually inside of the lender. You know, they have a separate little office. They're asked to, you've been in New York, things are going to be different. So that's what's funny about the differences between your part of the country and mine, is that things are just set up differently. So it's interesting when we discover the different distinctions between New York being up north, North Carolina being down south, South Carolina, and out west, I'm sure there's a whole different beast going on over there. So yeah, a lot of times the trustee is actually a part of the lender's institution, which, I found that interesting too. So may ask the trustee to undertake a foreclosure outside of court, assuming state laws direct trust deeds to empower the trustee with a power of sale clause. So I think that's interesting, definitely, depending on what state you live in. And then the trustee starts the foreclosure process by recording a notice of default, which, we went over earlier.
Right. And so the mechanism by which you empower the trustee to take the sale, that's very technical. Yeah. You definitely want to check what your jurisdiction allows. But that said, the one thing I do want to point out is that everything is filed. So what does that mean? That means you're putting the public on notice, usually in the county clerk, but if there's a different way that it's done in your jurisdiction, that's fine. But the whole point of the filing is that this is a public process. People can look up that you're going through a foreclosure. If you're in a mortgage state, it's listed with every other case. So your name is out there. If you are in a deed of trust state, these notices are filed so they can be looked up. And why do they make it public? Well, because at some point there's going to be an auction. And also because at some point there might be people who have rights to the property who don't know about what's going on with this action and need to know about it because they need to step in and protect their rights. So these are all very public processes. So that said, we're getting to the point where there's a sale. That's where things kind of converge and start to become very similar again. Just like they started off similar with the 90-day notice, they start to become similar again, no matter where you are, what type of state you're in as far as deeds of trust or mortgage, there is an auction. And the purpose of that auction, again, is to liquidate the property, get as much money as possible, and get that money back to the lender. The auction is a public auction. They want as many people as possible who have an interest in purchasing the property to do so. If you're going to be an auction purchaser, just be very wary of the title issues.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think we should definitely go over some pros and cons for investing in short sale versus foreclosures, because, you know, I don't think we should leave out investors. I think, you know, there's going to be plenty of investors that listen to this podcast for good information and some insight and maybe some nuggets. You know, I definitely got some opinions and some ideas regarding some pros and cons. You think we should touch on some of that, or you want to hold it till later, or what?
Yeah, let me just wrap this up real quick. So after the auction, if somebody buys it, then it goes to that person. And I'm going to tell you the amount of wholesales that take place after a foreclosure auction is insane. A lot of people just go to the auction, put down their down payment. It's typically 10% where I am, but and then you come with the rest within 30 days. In some instances, I've heard a certain amount down to 10, and you come with the rest at auction. But usually you can get 30 days. It's insane how often somebody will come in with 10%, lock the property up, and then just quickly flip it. The amount of times I've sat at a closing table and there was a dude there just like kind of half asleep, waiting for a check to be cut to him so he could walk out, is ridiculous. Because he didn't have to worry about the property or woman, excuse me, gender assumption there.
Gender, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They just sit there half asleep and it's like, all right, sir, here's your check, huh? Oh, yeah, thanks. And walks out because they're not worried about anything. They just try to make sure that their signature's on the first contract is getting flipped to the next contract. It happens so many times I would say to myself, yo, I got to be in the wrong line of business. These guys are cleaning up. If the property's not sold at auction, usually the banks will bid on it for like a dollar or so, and they'll take title to the property, and then it becomes a real estate owned. And they own it, all right? So typically the property reverts to the lender if it's not sold at auction. And then they clean up the title. They do everything that they can short of repairing the property. And it usually takes about 6 months, to be honest with you. And then they put it on the market and they sell it. Banks do not want to own these properties because in the bank's charter, there is a provision that says that they can only own a certain amount of real estate before they either get penalties or they have to change the type of company they are. And obviously a bank wants to be a bank. It doesn't want to be a REIT, doesn't want to be a real estate holding company. So it has to offload these things as quick as possible so that it, especially if it has a national presence, so that it doesn't begin to run afoul of its charter.
Yeah, I think that's definitely should be understood because, you know, even myself, at some point there was some sort of confusion when it was like, okay, well, you know, all these REOs are real estate owned by banks. I mean, bank, why do you have so much property for sale? But, you know, it's definitely a quick process, or at least their desire is to make this as quick as possible. Like you said, so that they're not holding on to property, because the reality is, and, you know, that's my favorite saying. So, but, you know, banks are in the business of making money by lending money. They are not real estate investors where they hold property and, you know, or they sell property, they flip property. That's not what they do. So that's definitely a beautiful point. And it should be pointed out. And I'm glad you did. You know, and I love the fact that you have the experience that you have and you're able to talk us through a lot of these scenarios that maybe, you know, some people haven't gotten to that point yet, or they're aspiring to get to that point, or maybe they were nervous and didn't really understand, you know. So I believe that's what's beautiful about bringing this knowledge to the ears of the people, because you get to see that it's not as intimidating as maybe it used to be. You know, this happens, and there's lots of people that actually, I feel like you, when you hear the stories about people who show up in flip-flops and a tank top and collect a check because of the way things are set up, you know, they don't have to wear a suit because that's not the side that they're on. They're not the attorney. They're not even the realtor. They're just the person who understood that this property is worth more than it's being asked for it. I'm connected with people who are looking for properties like this. So as long as I'm the matchmaker, and everything's above board and done legally and properly and, you know, ethically, that, hey, I'm collecting, you know, a certain amount of money just for making sure that this process came together.
You, sir, have a governor's mind, because what a lot of the states are doing right now is they are actually making it so that in order to do wholesales, not all of them, but some of them are making it so that you have to be a realtor, because really you are just being a matchmaker. If you're going to regulate the other matchmakers in the market, then you're going to you need to regulate the wholesalers. At least that is the thought. So there are some states that are saying you can do a minimum of X amount, you know, pick a number, 6 or whatever they come up with, 5, 3 wholesales before you have to get your real estate license. And that's where we're going. And that's why it's probably a good idea to begin to consider getting your real estate license if you are an investor that has not done so. By the way, you said the reality is, as you're saying, mine is really and truly. You edit enough of these podcasts and you start to hear yourself and you know, your co-host, and you're like, wow, there are a lot of quirks and ticks that we, in just speaking in general, that we don't really realize until we are confronted with it.
Right. And you listen to recordings and recordings and recordings. Yep.
Right. I guess that's podcast life.
Oh yeah. We're in it.
We're in it. So right. So the reason why I'm even going over all of this is because when I started, I wasn't an attorney and I wasn't even a realtor. I just was a guy trying to figure out how to make some money off of real estate, not having a lot of money. And so my instinctual first step was to go to these banks. The banks have the money, the banks have the properties. And I found out very quickly, and this was validated as I, you know, once I even got more in the know as an attorney, and I apologize to anybody who this offends, but the people at the banks don't understand this either. And you'll be talking to somebody who manages REOs for a bank, manages the process of default for a bank, and they just know their part of it. And a lot of times, if they're honest, they'll say, I don't know. Other times they just won't answer your question, or they'll give you something that's misinformation. And so if you're trying to bridge the gap, especially as an investor, but also as a borrower that's going through default, and or also possibly as somebody who works for the banks and may be listening to this podcast, it's important to understand the entire process. It's important to understand that if you're going into an auction, that title might be an issue, that you have a very limited time frame in which to produce the money. It's important to understand that banks are highly incentivized on the REO side to make sure the title is clean, because then liability, premises liability, passes to them. Whereas if something happened during the foreclosure process, during the foreclosure action, or prior to the sale, presumably the property owner would be responsible for anything that happens. Once it's in the name of the bank, the bank now is responsible for anything that happens. There are what you call undertaking statutes that you have to pay to a local government for the fact that you're foreclosing, because they're afraid that if you foreclose, that this property is going to be vacant, and therefore you have to maintain it, and they have to maintain it, and they're not going to pay to cut the grass. You're going to pay them to cut the grass, and you're going to pay them to board up the property. So there's a lot that goes into this. And when you try to start off as an investor and you're asking questions, and the people on the other side of the phone who are at these lending institutions are giving you answers, but they don't understand why their policies are the way they are. If you understand why the policies are the way they are, you can move differently. You can move in a way that is advantageous to you. You'll know and be able to see the striking points and know when to get in there and when to get out, when to ask questions, when not to, when to accept something, and when to try to massage a rule. And that's, you know, if I had this information back when I was starting out, I would definitely have had a much smoother path. And you're not supposed to sit on the information. Information is supposed to flow. So I'm trying to do my part, and Conrad is trying to do his part to allow for that free flow of information.
You know, I completely agree. And I'm even going to admit, you know, and I'm sure I'm not the only person who's looked at it like this, and hopefully you've grown as I have. And if not, then right now is a great opportunity with this admission. You know, I used to wonder, why did people reveal or share information? I was looking at it, honestly, from a scarcity mindset. You know, I remember, especially getting started with real estate, I looked at things as, oh, wow. Well, if I share this information, then I'm only making my competition better, which is going to lessen my ability to get some of this pie. You know, pie represents, you know, money out here. So what I've learned is you're exactly right. Information is supposed to flow. And when you really dig deep enough, you realize that there isn't any secrets. The internet has bridged the gap. You know, my favorite saying, the reality is before the internet was around, you really had to either use what, encyclopedias, or you had to be around somebody knowledgeable about something, or good old-fashioned trial and error. But this being the information age and information flowing and the velocity of information, I think has really helped, you know, many people actually accelerate their growth, accelerate their knowledge, and also help other people. So I think that's really important. I wanted to point that out because, like I said, I used to be in a scarcity mindset where I figured if I have knowledge and I keep it, then I'm going to grow and I can do things and not have to worry about you infringing on my growth. When the reality is there is more than enough out here for everybody. I've definitely learned that. I've heard that multiple times. And, you know, if there's somebody listening that hasn't gotten to that point, that you understand, a scarcity mindset is what's going to keep you small and not grow. You know, you can relate it to something like, you know, if you have the ability to help somebody that you see is struggling, whether it's, you know, monetarily with a couple dollars, feed them, you know, there's ways that you can help people without hurting yourself. And if anything, I believe in karma. I believe it all comes back to you. So, yeah, definitely want to touch on that.
That's powerful. You really do have to get rid of the scarcity mindset. I want to speak about it, but I'll probably be repeating you. So, I'm just going to let that sit. But keep in mind that abundance is definitely the way to go. I think we've really hammered the REOs over the head. Let's get into short sales. This is a little bit shorter. I was going to say simpler. It's not simpler, but it's a shorter explanation. Right. A short sale is another branch of the discussion about default that we've already been having. You get a loan, you promise to pay it back, and for some reason you may have defaulted. You go about 90 days and you get that notice of default. Now, if you decide at that point as the homeowner that you need a way out, one way to get a way out is to sell the property. If you are in a situation where there's equity in the property and you know you can pay off the loan and walk away with some cash, you do that. It's a distressed sale. You might put some stipulations on the realtor to get it done quickly, but it's just an arm's length sale. If you find yourself in a situation where you don't have any equity in the property or the property is worth less than the loan, then you have to engage in a short sale. And what a short sale is, it's a transaction in which the bank agrees to sell the property for less than the amount of the loan. So the bank is going to take a hit because it originally wanted, let's say, $500,000 for the property, but it's going to get $350,000. How much is the property owner going to get? Nothing. Property owner is going to get nothing. They're going to be able to walk away without a fully executed foreclosure on their credit report, which remains there for 7 years. They'll just have instead the effects of the default, because obviously if you go 30 days behind on a payment, it's going to be reported to the credit bureaus. You go 60, it's going to be reported. You go 90, it's going to be reported. So you got 3 instances of missed payments there. But what you don't have is a bunch of instances of missed payments and a foreclosure or a bankruptcy, which is sometimes filed to stop a foreclosure. I really didn't want to get too much into that, but that is a strategy that a lot of people take right before the final judgment. And that stays the foreclosure. At some point, I'm going to have to make the legal disclosure that neither I nor Conrad are offering any legal advice. The opinions that you hear on this program are for informational purposes only, and we are not proceeding in such a way as to either offer or solicit the buying or selling of a security. But that said, you go through.
Well, let me throw a translation in there. But essentially, my co-host is saying, look, he might be an attorney. He's not your attorney. I might be a realtor. I'm not your realtor. You need to go find you some folks in your area that understand your particular situation, because once again, like I'm sure I've said in another episode, we don't want anybody going around saying, well, they said on Tret that I can bankrupt, foreclose, and short sale and no. You need to understand these are options. These are viable options. These are legal options. But your particular situation may require a different tax. So let's make sure that it's understood. This is for information, educational. This is not, hey, okay, so don't pay my mortgage and hide in the... No. So, okay, carry on.
I love this podcast.
You and me both.
All right, so you decide that you want to sell the property once you have defaulted and you're not going to be able to sell the property for any equity. You're not going to be able to walk away with any cash. The first step is to list the property with a realtor. So that is typical. And there's nothing that is any different with that process, except that you're going to inform the realtor that this is a short sale. A good realtor will figure it out anyway, but it's important that you let them know upfront just so that there's no confusion. Once the property is listed, you're going to proceed as normal. Now, you do want to let the lender know that you're proceeding through a short sale, just in case they have any programs that they can make you aware of, or just in case they have an internal process that they have to go through. Typically, what happens is once the lender finds out that a short sale is coming down the pipe, they're going to order an appraisal or a BPO, a broker price opinion, which is just having a realtor go out to the property and evaluate that. And they do that because it's cheaper than paying an appraiser. And also because realtors are a little bit more knowledgeable of the current value of the property, whereas an appraiser is more knowledgeable. An appraiser that's not a realtor, that is a little bit more knowledgeable about the theory of evaluating properties and about closed sales and things that basically already happened. All right. Then you're not going to go to an appraiser that's not a realtor and expect them to know the value of a house now, but he or she will know what the house sold for next door or what the house was listed for across the street.
Well, let's be clear. Isn't a short sale is not going to take place without the permission of the lender anyway. So
that's right.
Right. So, you know, make sure it's understood, listeners, that you have to get the permission of the lender, because you may want to sell their property short of what you owe, but they need to give you their blessings before right. you even find a realtor, find a buyer, agree on a contract, all that good stuff. So that's why it's important. Talk to your lender, be upfront, be transparent. Just wanted to throw that little nugget in there.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. What I was debating is when you should engage a lender. Call them before you get the realtor in case they tell you, hey, wait a second, we don't care what you do, we're foreclosing on this property.
Exactly.
Once you've actually let your lender know, you've gotten the realtors listed, the next milestone in the transaction is once you get an offer and then proceed to contract. In the areas where the broker writes up the contract and there really isn't an offer, the offer is the contract, then once you're in contract, you're at the next stage. In the states where you need an attorney to get into a contract and there is an offer, banks don't want to hear about an offer. They want you to be in fully executed contracts. Mm-hmm. So once you're in fully executed contract, you're going to send a copy of the contract over along with a short sale package. So a package of your financials, ideally a CMA from your realtor, your bank statements. And you don't need to know this offhand and you don't need to take notes on this because every bank has its own set of documents. So when you contact the lender, it will tell you what you need to send in or a set of requirements, excuse me. If all their requirements are streamlined more or less, they have their own format that they want you to use and they have their own system that they have to upload it into. Your realtor and your attorney start to become your contact with the bank once you are a property owner that's in default. And you have to give them authorization and there are some standard forms for that. But then the banks start to communicate with them. The lender starts to communicate with them and they take the information, they run it through their own model and they get an idea of what the property's worth through their appraisal or their BPO. And then they come back to you and they either approve the sale or they give you a counter or they deny the sale. And once they have approved the sale, you have somewhere between 30 and 90 days to close with their approval. The lenders are very, very quick to pull their approval on the 90th day or on the 60th day or on the 30th day. So do not play around with those timeframes. Sometimes you'll even be about to close and they will hold it up. Try to close well within those timeframes. And once you do that, you now have an executed short sale. Everybody can move forward. there are some restrictions. Like, for example, you cannot then turn around and flip that property if you are the purchaser. There's a little bit of seasoning that's required. There are also some restrictions on where the money comes from for the down payment and things like that. So the short sale is not the place to try to work your magic if you are an investor. It's the place to get a good deal, but it's highly regulated because there's been a lot of fraud with it.
Yep. You know, a short sale is not a way to escape your obligations. This was one of the options on the table regarding, you know, the situation I was dealing with. And, you know, I had to weigh this out. I had to weigh it out. I had to think about it. I had to think about where I was mentally, what, from my current knowledge, how did I understand what would be best for my situation? So that's why I'm glad that I've gotten deeper. I've made some connections. I have resources and people I can reach out to help guide me in the process. So
this is not a get out of jail free card, because in some states, the lender can actually go after you for the difference and under a personal judgment. They're not coming after you using the property. They're coming after you saying that you promised to pay this amount and you didn't do it, and you signed a contract that you would. And there are also some tax consequences as well, because you bought a property at $500,000, you sold it at $350,000, you still have an obligation for that $500,000 underneath the loan. Tax-wise, there was this $150,000 that magically went away. Mm-hmm. And so according to the tax authorities, you were given $150,000. And so you have to now pay taxes on that. And there are ways you have to navigate that. There's one more very quick aspect of this I want to go into, and that's the deed in lieu. So if you are a property owner and you're going through a default and you just don't want to deal with it and you don't want the foreclosure on your record and you don't want to sell it, you can call up your lender and say, listen, I will send you the property. I will send you the keys. I want out. And sometimes the lender will accept that because they don't have to go through the expense of a lawsuit or the expense of conducting a trustee sale. So they will take the property. They will become the property owner and then they'll just turn around and sell it. Why would they sell it? For the same reasons that we discussed earlier. They don't want to hold on to it because they're worried about their charter, but also they're worried about, like, these mortgages a lot of times aren't owned by them anymore. They sell these mortgages to people, or they sell them to, like, these companies that are called securitization entities. And so the securitized entity has this this loan. They gave them money because they sold it, right? So they gave the lender money. The lender gave them the loan, and they're sitting over there waiting for their money back.
You just reminded me that's exactly what we ended up going through, was a deed in lieu. That was a very interesting process.
All right. So, Conrad, you asked me earlier, which do I think is better, a short sale or a foreclosure? I'm going to unequivocally say short sale because of the mitigated damage that it does to your credit report. A foreclosure stays there for a while. If it takes 5 years, you're 5 years in default. Whereas if it takes you 90 days, 6 months to sell your house, you're only in default for 6 months.
Well, honestly, now from, you know, the bank and from the homeowner's perspective, I completely agree. What I wanted to touch on was for our investing community, I wanted to touch on some of the pros and cons regarding should they invest in a short sale or should they invest in foreclosure property. So, like, for example, if we're looking at some of the pros for foreclosure, I would say that there's definitely the ability to possibly find properties that are sold below market value, which means that, you know, investors often can secure a better deal when compared to properties that are listed on the MLS. I'd say that after taking control of the property, banks often, they want to just liquidate the asset quickly, which means, you know, they're not, like we stated earlier, they're not in the market for to be a property owner. They're in the market of having notes and money alone. So they're not happy that they have to take over property. So their goal is to get rid of this property as fast as possible. Now, not necessarily for the lowest, but they are incentivized not to worry about building up the price. It's more like, hey, let's look for a fair price that we can get this thing sold as fast as possible, so it's not on our books for that long. And I'd say another pro as far as an investor looking for a foreclosure would be the ability for cash buyers increasing the likelihood of walking away with a deal. You know, if nobody else is bidding on a property, then more than likely you're going to get it for at or below potential market value. So how do you feel about those pros?
I like the pros. If you're asking me, should you do a short, like should you purchase a short sale as an investor or a foreclosure as an investor? The answer is yes.
To both, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
The answer is yes. So whatever the deal is, if it works for you, do it. I do want to clarify that all this stuff is on the MLS. All of it is on the MLS because you can't do a FSBO short sale, for sale by owner, excuse me. You can't sell the house yourself because the banks want to make sure it's arm's length and it's above board. And if you sell the house yourself, they can have like zero assurances that you either didn't sell it to your cousin or you purposely are not selling it for 9 months so you can go to them and be like, hey, no activity on this. And meanwhile, you're still living in the property for 9 months. Putting on the MLS ensures them that a third party is definitely trying to sell it. And there are regulations around it because, you know, the MLS is regulated. REOs are on the MLS for the same reason. Banks want a third party who's knowledgeable and who has shown that they have the ability to successfully sell these properties to sell the property as soon as possible. So they're usually on the MLS.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, I do have to completely agree that the answer is yes to either or when it comes to foreclosure, short sale. It's definitely yes, but it's also make sure you understand the situation you're getting into because there is some unique opportunities, but some unique pitfalls that you want to make sure you navigate. So yes, you know, I'm going to have to just second that and say yes.
We could talk about this forever, but I definitely want to keep to our, not really our time limit, but keep this in line with the other podcasts that are out there because we are developing this audience here and we want to make sure that we give you something within your expectations. And we're going to move on to our market corner. Before Conrad hits you with the numbers in his area, I want to just focus on one aspect of the market. And I mentioned this earlier. I'm going to say it again. The moratorium on foreclosures has been extended to June 30th. That means that you cannot start foreclosure until the 30th. What that's going to do is we've actually been in this season of quarantine and then semi-quarantine after, I guess we'll say quarantine and recovery for about a year. And there were people who were on the verge of default that were there a year ago. There are people who were actually in default a year ago. Their foreclosures haven't started yet. And we're a year out. And in that time, I would imagine even more people have fallen into that category, given the drastic change in our lifestyles because of the pandemic, given the economy, given the job market. And so we can assume with a lot of confidence that the number of defaults is a lot higher than it was a year ago. And during this time, there hasn't been the ability to start any actions to remedy some of these issues. And I don't want to be callous. I don't want to try to say that people need to be on the street. But what I am trying to say is that there is going to be a glut of these actions that need to be filed. And I don't know how many of them are actually going to make it to the court. And whatever the percentage might be, it's going to be larger than zero, which is what it is now. And so unless we have some creative solutions, there are going to be a lot of investment opportunities that are going to come forth as the real estate market corrects itself post-moratorium. And if you are savvy, you will be able to see these opportunities as they open up and take advantage of them. We are in a market now where real estate has been an opportunity for quick players for, at this point, a decade and a half to two decades. So the playbook to capitalizing off of real estate is out there, and people are going to move very quickly once they figure out a way to monetize this opportunity. So it's important to be one of the first people to start thinking about this now because the window of opportunity is going to close much faster than it may have in 2009 or it would have in 1993 when we had the commercial real estate fall and the subsequent foreclosure boom in 96. So it's important that you begin this mindset now and you look for creative ways to capitalize on what we know is going to be an increase in defaults.
You know, I completely agree. I would definitely say this is one of the reasons that I went ahead on and got my license. And it's unfortunate, but, you know, I've heard the saying, don't let a good crisis go to waste. I mean, there's tons of people who during downtimes and during crisis, the amount of money they have goes up. And that's why I'm sure I say this for Stefan as well. You know, another benefit to us doing this podcast is the educational value, is the informational value, is the ability to get your mind to open up to realize, you know what? There is lots of opportunities going on out here that sometimes you're not going to be privy to, but even worse is the ones that you could be involved in, you're just not, because you just had no idea of what was going on. You know, rolling on into the market report, of course, as usual, per Canopy Realtor Association, I provide this information. So for the week ending February 27th, this date is current as of March 8th, 2021, home prices in the Charlotte market continue to rise at a fast pace and nationally, with the median sales price of existing homes up 14.1% in January 2021 from the same time last year. Sales also were up, with January seasonally adjusted annual existing home sales climbing 23.7% from the year before. Low supply of homes for sale continued to be an issue, as sales easily could have been even 20% higher if there had been more inventory and more choices, according to NAR chief economist Lawrence Yun. And the Charlotte region for the week ending February 27th reports like this: new listings decreased 11.6% year over year to 1,141. That's interesting. Pending sales increased 14.8% year over year to 1,278. Inventory decreased 60.3% year over year to 3,230, which is, you know, one of those interesting topics that we're going to touch on a lot, because the reality is, with inventory decreasing, it's going to definitely keep prices at a certain high. And with the moratorium and everything that's coming down the pike in the future, it's really interesting to see which way this goes. In the Charlotte margin, in the month of February, the median sales price increased 11.4% year over year to $292,500. That's a good thing. The list to close decreased 12% year over year to 88%. Of original list price received increased 2.6% year over year to 99.3%. And the months of supply of homes for sale decreased 68.4% year over year to 0.6 months. So definitely some stuff to keep an eye on there here in the Charlotte region market.
You said 0.6 months. Like, let's really think about that for a second.
Yes.
There's less than a month worth of inventory on the market, and that's decreasing right now.
And what did we say a healthy market is? 6 months?
6 months, yeah. That's literally ridiculous.
Yes, that's why it's so interesting that this information is out here. You know, so that's what we're here for. We're here to help, you know, spread the knowledge and help you to be a wiser, just more informed person.
I mean, let's put that in layman's terms.
Yes.
Although it doesn't actually mean this, the numbers are indicating that if you were to put your house on the market, there's so little inventory on there that any house that comes out in about 2.5 weeks is going to be sold. That is historical.
Down here, I can't speak for up there, but down right here,
right?
Oh man, you know, I'm really looking forward to having my team leader, his name is Brock Zeeman, as a guest on this podcast, because he's going to help me explain. And even my mentor, Michael Kastner, it's amazing how these properties are going up. Sometimes they're not even going up. Like, people are purchasing properties sight unseen. Like, it's insane.
So that concludes episode 5 of the Real Estate Think Tank podcast.
5.
I know. Isn't that something else?
5. We're doing this, brother.
We're doing it. I am Stefan Martin. He is
Conrad Bastian Jr.
We hope you guys are enjoying the beginnings of spring, and we will see you all in the next one. Y'all have a good day.
Well, you know, I have one request, right?
What's that, man?
Oh, well, come on. Anybody who's listening, you know what I'm going to ask. Where's that theme song at?